Pub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 46. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's a balloon? Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to talk about the early history of flight in Boston. Before there were drones, before we debated whether a public heliport's needed along Fort Point Channel, before the airplane was even invented, Bostonians were taking to the skies. The early pioneers of flight worked with balloons lofted by hot air and hydrogen, including some right here in Boston. But before we talk about Boston's early history with balloons, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is September 18th, and Massachusetts got a little bit smaller on September 18th, 1679, when King Charles II issued a royal commission. Charles II, to all whom these presents shall come, greeting. Whereas our colony of the Massachusetts Bay in New England in America have taken upon themselves to exercise a government and jurisdiction over the inhabitants and planters in the towns of Portsmouth, Hampton, Dover, Exeter, and all other towns and lands in the province of New Hampshire, not having any legal right or authority so to do, which said jurisdiction and all further exercise thereof, we have thought fit by the advice of our Privy Council to inhibit and restrain for the future, and do hereby inhibit and restrain the same. And whereas the government of that part of said province of New Hampshire hath not yet been granted unto any person or persons whatsoever, but the same still remains and is under our immediate care and protection. To the end, therefore, that our loving subjects, the planters and inhabitants within the limits aforesaid, may be protected and defended in their respective rights, liberties, and properties, and that due and impartial justice may be duly administered in all cases civil and criminal, and that all possible care may be taken for the quiet and orderly government of the same. Now know ye that we, by and with the advice of our Privy Council, have thought fit to erect and constitute, and by these presents for us or heirs and successors do erect, constitute, and appoint a president and council to take care of the said tract of land called the province of New Hampshire.
After speculating for a few days as to whether General Howe, the British commander, would be able to take the American capital at Philadelphia, John Adams was woken in the wee hours of September 19th, 1777, with a dire warning. At 3 this morning was waked by Mr. Lovell and told that the members of Congress were gone, some of them, a little after midnight. That there was a letter from Mr. Hamilton, aide-de-camp to the general, informing that the enemy were in possession of the ford and the boats and had it in their power to be in Philadelphia before morning. And that if Congress was not removed, they had not a moment to lose. Mr. Merchant and myself arose, sent for our horses, and after collecting our things, rode off after others. Hey, look at that. Alexander Hamilton did something useful for once.
Wednesday is September 20th. Boston's beloved USS Constitution took 3 years to construct. George Cleghorn was the naval constructor in charge of building the new frigate at Edmund Hart's shipyard in the North End. He had to source the copper sheathing, live oak beams, and white oak planking. Then, he had to build a new stone wharf and launching way big enough to accommodate the largest ship ever built in Boston. Dry docks wouldn't exist in the United States for 36 more years, so the ship would have to be built on a wooden ramp, then slid down into the water when it was time to launch it. Because the ship was 145 feet long, the upper end of the launching way had to be over 7 feet off the ground. By June of 1797, the Constitution's hull was fully planked. In July, the copper sheathing was nailed on, and by August, she was ready to launch. Further construction would take place on the water.
Hey, this is Jake from the editing room. Just want to point out that the Constitution was being launched on September 20th, 1797, and that's what the anniversary is. We didn't actually say so specifically in the script. Sorry about that.
To launch the shipyard workers had to perform a series of intricate operations to move the hull into position and slide it toward the water. The hull had been built atop a series of long, straight-grained white pine blocks. Workers with axes and mauls split these blocks, allowing the hull of the Constitution to tip onto a specially constructed launching cradle that was designed to slip like a bobsled down the launching way. As the tide rose to meet the ship, workers covered the wooden rails and cradle with oil and tallow to lubricate them. When the tide crested, a few sure-footed yard dogs used mallets to knock out the remaining blocks holding the ship in place, and axes to cut the ropes securing the cradle. With an audience made up of officials from the city and state, naval officers, and thousands of curious Bostonians looking on, nothing happened. Claycorn borrowed a screwjack and managed to push the Constitution into motion, but it only slid 27 feet down the ramp before stopping. As the tide ebbed away, he ordered new blocks to be fixed, holding the ship in place. The crowd drifted away. We imagine there must have been a certain amount of laughter in the air. Closely examining his apparatus, Claycorn discovered that part of the launching way had settled by half an inch. The major problem, however, was a stone that had somehow found its way onto one of the wooden rails. He corrected the problem, and 2 days later, the pomp and circumstance of the launch returned. Again, the ship slowed to a halt before it hit the water. This time, the stone wharf itself had settled under the massive weight of the ship. The USS Constitution Museum commiserates with the beleaguered constructor. Poor Claghorn. Here, in front of dignitaries and a large portion of the population of Boston and the surrounding towns, he had twice failed to launch the ship. In a letter to Elias Boudinot, Rachel Bradford observed that Claghorn actually appeared to have lost flesh in 8 and 40 hours, from mortification and vexation. What was worse, the opponents of the shipbuilding program and the federal government now had an abundance of inspiration for their impudent speeches, sad predictions, and sarcastic remarks. Finally, on October 21st, 1797, the USS Constitution was successfully launched in front of a considerably smaller crowd. As she approaches her 220th birthday, she is the oldest commissioned warship in the world, and the last U.S. Navy ship to defeat an enemy with naval gunfire.
As this podcast has covered many times in the past, Quakers were roughly treated in the early days of Massachusetts. Anyone who proclaimed that faith could be jailed, whipped, or if they persisted, even executed. On September 21st, 1657, three Quakers were publicly flogged in Boston, probably on Boston Common. Christopher Holder and John Copeland were seized in Salem, and after being very roughly handled, were had to Boston. Here the operation of whipping was performed with a knotted whip of three cords, with all the physical ability the hangman could command. Another friend, Samuel Shattuck of Salem, had to suffer the same for interfering when Holder was gagged.
Friday is September 22nd. In one of the saddest episodes we've recounted on the podcast, episode 27 told the story of an enslaved woman named Mariah, who was burned at the stake in Boston on September 22, 1681. She confessed to deliberately setting fire to two houses in Roxbury that June, and she was convicted and sentenced to death on September 6. The prisoner at the bar pleaded and acknowledged herself to be guilty of the fact. And accordingly, the next day, being again brought to the bar, had the sentence of death pronounced against her by the Honorable Governor, that she should go from the bar to the prison whence she came, and then to the place of execution, and there be burned. The Lord be merciful to thy soul, said the Governor. At the time, English law considered common means of execution, such as hanging, drawing, or quartering, to be too revealing of a woman's body, and thus immodest. Instead, Mariah would be burned to death, subjecting her to unspeakable pain in order to preserve her modesty. And that is some sexist bullfeathers. The Diary of Increase Mather records that the sentence was carried out on September 22nd. 1681, September 22nd. There were three persons executed in Boston. An Englishman for a rape. A Negro man for burning a house at Northampton. And a Negro woman who burnt two houses at Roxbury, July 12th, in one of which a child was burnt to death. The Negro woman was burned to death, the first yet suffered such a death in New England.
On September 23rd, 1815, a great gale blew into Boston with hurricane-force winds. In his 1871 History of the City, former Mayor Nathaniel Shurtleff wrote, "This tremendous gale, which will ever be memorable in the annals of Boston, occurred on Saturday, the 23rd of September. The damage to buildings was exceedingly great. Several of the chimneys of the State House were upset, as were also about 60 others in different parts of the town. The steeples of Old South, Hollis Street, Charles Street Baptist, and Park Street meeting houses were much injured, and barely escaped being blown down. The roofs of several buildings were taken off, and a great destruction of slates and window glass ensued from the violence of the gale. One building was entirely blown down and burnt, the old wooden glass house in Essex Street, and the shipping in the harbor and at the wharves was very much injured. But we are told that the most impressive scene was exhibited on the common and in its immediate vicinity. Many of the old and stately trees which formed the old mall and skirted the common were torn up by their roots and prostrated, carrying the fences with them. And several of the large elms of Paddock's Mall shared the same fate, overturning a portion of the brick wall of the burial ground. One of the trees of the old mall measured then 7 feet and 11 inches in girth. He goes on to note that the current iron fences were built around the common after the great September gale, and the destroyed trees were replaced by American elms. Those elms that have survived Dutch elm disease are now among the most impressive of their genus in the country.
Finally, Sunday is September 24th. If New Hampshire was desperate to get out of Massachusetts in 1679, a century later, another northern territory was desperate to get in. On September 24th, 1776, a committee of the residents of Sunbury County, Nova Scotia, wrote to the Massachusetts state government. "The inhabitants on the River St. John are desirous of committing themselves to the government and protection of the province or state of the Massachusetts Bay. It is the humble request of the aforesaid committee that if the inhabitants on the River St. John's are esteemed as a part of the free states of America, your honors would be pleased to signify it to them, and give directions for their future conduct, who are ready at all times to pursue every measure in their power that you shall prescribe. And your memorialists, as in duty bound, shall ever pray for the peace and prosperity of the American states, and for the preservation of your honor's lives and administration. Residents of the area, which is now near St. John's, New Brunswick, were largely Massachusetts expatriates and their children. After Britain won the Acadia region from France during the Seven Years' War, they gave the French Acadian residents the choice of submitting to the British crown and converting to Protestantism, or departing from the colony. In their place, officials invited New England planters, many of whom were from Massachusetts, to settle. Maine remained contested throughout the Revolutionary War, and in the end, about a third of Sunbury County was given to the U.S. in 1784. The St. John's River was at the heart of a frontier territory between Maine and British Canada that wasn't settled until the Webster-Ashburton Treaty of 1842.
Manned flight has its origins in France in 1783. A couple of weeks ago on the podcast, we quoted a letter that John Adams wrote to Abigail from Paris in September of that year. He was eager to see Abigail, and said, "If the balloon should be carried to such perfection as to give mankind the safe navigation of the air, I will fly in one of them at the rate of 30 knots an hour." His confidence was a little bit premature, but it goes to show how much hype there was around balloons at the time. That summer, the Montgolfier brothers demonstrated a hot air balloon for the first time. Joseph Michel and Jacques Étienne were papermakers who had been experimenting with the idea of flight since they watched scraps of paper rising out of a fire. Believing that there was a special gas in smoke that was lighter than air, they built small balloons out of paper and taffeta over wood frames, lit small fires under them, and were pleased to see the contraptions rise off the ground. By June of 1783, they had conducted their first public demonstration of a balloon, which got them noticed in Paris. That September, a sheep, a duck, and a rooster became the first creatures to ascend in a balloon, flying from the royal palace at Versailles with Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette looking on. When both fowl and the more terrestrial sheep survived a flight of some 1,500 feet of altitude, the king decided to allow human testing. In October, Étienne became the first human to ascend in a balloon, in a secret test performed at the brothers' workshop. Later that day, a physicist friend also ascended in a tethered balloon at their shop. In November, the physicist would make a public ascent in Paris, accompanied by a French army officer. They soared to 3,000 feet and traveled almost 6 miles before touching down outside the city walls. This public flight touched off a round of balloon fever in France, with everything from shirt sleeves to seat backs being designed with balloon-like flares, and colorful balloons were printed on all kinds of consumer products.
Just 2 years later, as balloon fever raged on, the first Bostonian took to the skies. Dr. John Jeffries was a physician from Boston. He's an interesting character, and he'll probably pop up in future podcasts. He worked closely with John Adams as a witness for the defense in the Boston Massacre trial, but as the American Revolution heated up, he became a staunch loyalist. He served as a physician in the Royal Army during the war before moving to London. There, he ended up becoming personal physician to the Adams family while John was serving as America's first ambassador to Great Britain. As she was waiting for Jeffries to deliver her first grandchild, Abigail Adams would say, "Dr. Jeffries is our family physician and is really an amiable, benevolent man, though formerly he took a different side in politics." Later, Jeffries would move back to Boston, but it was during his exile in London that he made aviation history. About a year after the Montgolfiers first demonstrated balloon flight, a French balloonist and daredevil named Jean-Pierre Blanchard arrived in London and began giving demonstrations. As a man of science, Jeffries was fascinated. After being carried aloft in a brief ascent from London, he offered to fund Blanchard's next major undertaking, on the condition that he be allowed to come along as a scientific observer. Together, the two staged a balloon and supplies in Dover and waited for the weather to turn in their favor. On January 7th, 1785, the day dawned clear with a light breeze from the west. They began to inflate Blanchard's balloon with hydrogen, which, at that time, meant mixing iron filings with sulfuric acid in barrels and piping it into the balloon. Funnily, they ascended, with Jeffries carrying a barometer to measure their altitude as they progressed. As the breeze carried them slowly across the English Channel, the flight passed into history. They were the first to cross the Channel by air, and the first ever international flight. Over Calais, Jeffries dropped a letter from Ben Franklin's son William to the American delegation in Paris, which is now considered the world's first piece of airmail. Despite making history, the flight was not without difficulties. About a month after their ascent, Jeffries met John Quincy Adams at a dinner with Ben Franklin in Paris. John Quincy's diary records the tense atmosphere aboard the balloon. "Dined at Dr. Franklin's with a great deal of company, among the rest, Dr. Jeffries, who lately crossed with Mr. Blanchard from Dover to Calais. He related his voyage, in which his intrepidity had well nigh been fatal to him. The balloon descended, he says, 3/4 of a mile in 2 minutes. He and Mr. Blanchard were both of them obliged to throw almost all of their clothes into the water. At one time, they were not more than 20 yards above the surface." So, Jeffries and Blanchard had arrived in France half-naked, having thrown all their equipment and most of their clothing overboard to gain altitude as they drifted across the English Channel.
After that history-making voyage, Jean-Pierre Blanchard would bring his balloon to the United States. He ascended from Walnut Street Prison in Philadelphia on January 9, 1793. President Washington and a group of dignitaries were on hand to witness the feat, along with hundreds who paid to watch him take off from inside the walls of the prison, and even more who skipped the admission fee and watched from the surrounding streets. About an hour later, he touched down in New Jersey. Even after ballooning took off in the U.S., it would be decades before the first documented ascent from Boston. Back in the early 20th century, there was a club in Boston that called itself the Association of International Aeronautical Pilots of America. They had formed in 1908 as a way for licensed balloonists to trade tips and tricks, and they continued meeting until at least 1920, well into the era of airplane flight. Their annual meeting was held on November 1st, and they claimed the date was chosen to mark the anniversary of the first balloon ascent in Boston, which they imply was given by Dr. Jeffries, and say was held on November 1st, 1790, in front of the Green Dragon Tavern. The only reference we can find to this date as the first ascent in Boston is in a newsletter called Aero, where the club is advertising their annual banquet. It's possible that the date refers to the demonstration of a small unmanned balloon. It's equally possible that the event in 1790 was completely made up.
There may not be any evidence to back up that claim for a 1790 balloon ascent, but there is plenty of evidence for the first official ascent in Boston. And that evidence is the first aviation-related lawsuit in Massachusetts. On September 3rd, 1821, the aeronaut Louis Charles Gill took off from Washington Gardens on Tremont Street across from the Common. The flight seemed to be successful, and the balloon descended at Ten Hills Farm in Somerville. A man named Swan had a large commercial vegetable garden there at the time. An article about the trial describes the descent. The facts are there stated as follows. Gill ascended in a balloon in the vicinity of Swan's garden and descended into his garden. When he descended, his body was hanging out of the car of the balloon in a very perilous situation, and he called to a person at work in Swan's field to help him, in a voice audible to the pursuing crowd. After the balloon descended, it dragged along over potatoes and radishes about 30 feet when Gill was taken out. The balloon was carried to a barn at the farther end of the premises. Gill and his balloon caused an estimated $15 of damage to Mr. Swan's farm. The real problem came when 200 or more people broke down Mr. Swan's fences, trampling his fields in an attempt to see the balloon. They caused at least $75 in damage. The jury found that Gill's shouts for help made him liable for the crowd's damage and assessed a judgment against him for $90. Almost a century later, newspapers would cite the case as a note of warning for barnstorming aviators who might land in farm fields.
A decade after that first ascent by Louis Charles Gill, balloon ascents were a popular entertainment for the people of Boston. In the last week of August and the first 2 weeks of September 1834, Charles Durant built a temporary amphitheater on Boston Common and gave a series of balloon demonstrations. An Irish actor touring the States recorded his impressions of the crowd waiting expectantly for one of Durant's ascents. On arriving at Boston, I found the whole city in movement to assist, as the French say, in the ascent of a balloon, constructed by a Mr. Durant, already well known as an experienced and intrepid aeronaut. Purchasing a ticket for the amphitheater, a lofty temporary enclosure with rows of seats running round it, I fell into the crowd, and made my way across the common at the extremity of which the building in question was situated. On this day, the whole area was alive with expectant gazers, whilst the several lines of streets leading into it were thronged with hurrying reinforcements. Selecting a good point of vantage, I stood for some time examining the materials out of which this vast congregation was made up, and I have never seen a population whose general appearance would endure so close a scrutiny as well. I computed that the women outnumbered their less attractive companions by at least a third. These were all in holiday trim, of course, invariably well-dressed, but commonly having a pretension to taste and style I have never elsewhere observed so universally prevalent amongst the same class. The men, both in air and dress, were inferior to their female friends, so much so that it was difficult to imagine them belonging to the same order. And this remark, I think, will be found generally to apply throughout the Union. After a time, I slowly made my way to the amphitheater, presented my ticket, and was admitted within the enclosure, where the arrangements for the flight were in busy progress. The Boston Post noted Durant's first ascent on August 25th, when he drifted around the city on gently shifting winds, before eventually landing near Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge. The Post quoted Durant's account of a publicity stunt staged during that first flight. After about an hour, he attained a sufficient easterly position to allow the rabbit and parachute to reach Boston. As I was then over the Back Bay, I judged the best plan to give the spectators a view of the descent of the rabbit would be to keep in the lower current and thus reach the land on the western side of the Back Bay. At 4 hours and 49 minutes, I judged myself sufficiently over the land to let go of the rabbit. The barometer then stood at 2602, the thermometer at 68 degrees, and 4 minutes after I saw him land. A number of persons on foot and in carriages hastened to the spot and caught the parachute before it touched the earth.
That first ascent got the town talking, but it was his last ascent from Boston on September 13th that was the most memorable to the aeronaut himself. His account appears in the American Magazine of Useful and Entertaining Knowledge, edited by Nathaniel Hawthorne. My 12th aerial voyage is so full of pleasing incidents to myself that I the more cheerfully comply with a request to furnish the minutes of the tour. He ascended from his amphitheater as usual and hovered over the Charles between the Common and Cambridgeport as he gradually rose to an altitude of 8,000 feet. A strong high-altitude air current began carrying him out over the harbor. When I descended to the lower current, I was over Fort Warren, and at 5 hours, 6 minutes was so near as to hear the remarks of persons on the island. My course was now changed, and again directed towards Boston. I went down to speak to a barge, which was heading to intersect my line of progression. I heard distinctly the remark of those on board. "Mr. Durant, do you intend to alight here?" I answered no and asked his name, wishing to report him in the city, but I could not understand his reply. The scene was becoming more and more interesting, and I think I never beheld so thrilling and animating a sight as was presented on approaching the city. The bay appeared alive, with vessels and boats of all classes. From one of them came delightful music, and approaching the wharves so near as to hear the bells and voices of thousands of fellow beings, waving handkerchiefs and hats to welcome my return, produced a pleasing sensation, which you may better imagine than I can describe. I rose as I entered the city to prevent danger from contact with steeples, though I passed sufficiently near to observe distinctly the movements of the inhabitants. He first attempted to land back at Boston Common, where his voyage began, but he overshot his goal. As the breeze carried him into Cambridgeport, he considered alighting in Harvard Yard, but was still moving too fast. At 5:34, I was opposite the college at Cambridge, and addressed an evening paper to Honorable Josiah Quincy, which I sent down with another that I found in the car, directed to a gentleman in Cambridgeport. At 6:01, I conversed with a gentleman who told me I was in Waltham, 10 miles from Boston, and desired I would come down. I gave him some evening papers which I found in the car, directed to gentlemen and newspaper offices in different parts of the United States. I requested he would put them in the post office, which he promised to do. After showing off for the folks on the ground, he realized that his anchor cables were dragging and in danger of tangling in the treetops. He cut them away, cast off some ballast, and soon rose to 1/2 mile above the ground level again. He finally landed on a farm in Lincoln, where onlookers quickly gathered to help Durant fold up the balloon. They carried him off to the nearest tavern, where many toasts were toasted, before he was taken back to Boston at the head of a veritable parade of chaises and carriages. Despite all the excitement, he was back at his own lodging before 11 p.m. The voyage throughout was to me the most interesting one that I ever performed. It is my last from Boston this season, and if it has met the approbation of your citizens, I shall enjoy the pleasure of having contributed to at least the gratification of an intelligent community, whose many acts of kind and polite attention towards me will forever leave a pleasing memento. Yours, C.F. Durant. Tremont House, Boston, 14th September 1834.
As early as the Napoleonic Wars, military leaders saw the potential of balloons to allow their scouts to peer deep behind enemy lines. However, it wasn't until after the invention of photography that this dream became practical. The world's first aerial photograph was taken of Paris in 1858, though it's long since been lost. The very next year, the French army began using balloons to photograph enemy lines during the Franco-Austrian War. In 1860, a photo was taken that is now the world's oldest surviving aerial photograph. On October 8th, the Boston Herald carried an account by a Samuel King of King and Allen Aeronauts, who had ascended in his balloon Queen of the Air with photographer James Wallace Black. Mr. Black, the eminent photographic artist of the firm Black and Batchelder, and I ascended together. First of all, we arose to 1,200 feet, but we wished to get more extended views that could be obtained at such a height. And so after being drawn down and detaching the rope, we ascended in the usual manner. Soon an expansive field was opened to us, and we hoped to be able to secure some of the magnificent scenes which we now scanned. Everything was in readiness, and an attempt was made to take the city that was now sitting so beautifully for her picture. But just at the time, we encountered a difficulty which had never before suggested itself. The gas, expanding as the balloon rose, filled the surrounding atmosphere, penetrating even into the camera, neutralizing the effect of the light and turning the coating on the glass plate to a uniform dark brown color. Several plates were spoiled in this manner before we discovered the cause, by which we lost very much precious time as we were rapidly drifting away in a southerly direction. 5 days later, they repeated the attempt, and on October 13, 1860, the first aerial photo was captured of Boston. Describing it in The Atlantic in 1863, Oliver Wendell Holmes waxed poetic. Boston, as the eagle and wild goose see it, is a very different object from the same place as the solid citizen looks up at its eaves and chimneys. The Old South and Trinity Church are two landmarks not to be mistaken. Washington Street slants across the picture as a narrow cleft. Milk Street winds as if the old cowpath which gave it its name had been followed by the builders of its commercial palaces. Windows, chimneys, and skylights attract the eye in the central parts of the view, exquisitely defined, bewildering in numbers. As a first attempt, it is on the whole a remarkable success, but its greatest interest is in showing what we may hope to see accomplished in the same direction.
Much as those first ascents in gas and hot air balloons in the 1780s only barely hinted at the world of aviation to follow, this early photograph taken from a balloon only scratches the surface of what aerial photography would one day offer. Google, makers of the most widely used modern aerial photographs, wrote a blog post in October of 2010. 150 years ago today, on October 13, 1860, James Wallace Black shot the earliest still existing aerial photograph in the U.S. He took the picture from a hot air balloon suspended above Boston Common, and the result, titled Boston as the Eagle and the Wild Goose See It, is truly beautiful. We at Google owe James Wallace Black a debt of gratitude. Without his early experimentation with aerial imagery, Google Earth may never have come to be. Technology has come a long way since James Wallace Black took his photo of Boston, and glass plate negative box cameras and hot air balloons have given way to airplanes with mounted camera arrays. But what hasn't changed is how technology gives us new ways to look at our world. Soon after that 1860 ascent, a civil war broke out in America in which balloon-based photography would be widely used for surveillance. After the war, interest would soon turn to powered airships that could be navigated by some means other than the vagaries of shifting winds. And by the 1920s, a small airfield had opened in East Boston to serve the growing number of heavier-than-air flyers who called Boston home. But that's another topic for another podcast.
To learn more about the early history of ballooning in Boston, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/046. We'll have a link to John Quincy Adams' account of the first flight across the English Channel, Durant's complete account of his dramatic flight, and that dubious account of a 1790 ascent from Boston. We'll post an engraving of Durant's ascent from the Common and a copy of the first 1860 aerial photo of Boston. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries. After episode 44 about perambulating the bounds went out, William Ricker tweeted at us, "Dress for ticks if perambulating. If you get to be the delegation, or do it without, I might be interested in hiking along. And I have flasks." He also added several links to resources about perambulation, town lines, and boundary stones, which we'll link to in this week's show notes.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It is the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week.